We'll reconvene the meeting of the Washington State Fish and Wildlife Commission. We are now on agenda item 8. This is a blue sheet, cooperative projects between WDFW and the Confederated Tribes of the Caldwell Reservation. And this is a briefing, and we're honored by having Mr. Donnelly. I'm sorry you didn't drive over, Mr. Donnelly.
Yeah, such a rare event not to get to see you in person, and I'm so sorry I didn't get to do it. Thank you for having me, Chair Carpenter and Commissioner. And for the record, I'm Chris Donnelly, Region 1, Acting Regional Director, soon to be back to Fish Program November 1st. It's a privilege to be here and meet up with the second portion of the Blue Sheet request from Commissioner Graybill. In the presentation that we'll give you today, we have Holly McClellan, who's a principal biologist for the Caldwell Tribe, as well as principal biologist for the Caldwell Tribe, as well as Casey Baldwin, a senior research scientist. We're going to go over two projects that we do collaboratively in the Upper Columbia Basin. I just want to make sure that I highlight that we do a lot of work together, and these are just two examples of the many things that we do, both in fish, wildlife habitat work, as well as at the policy level. So with that, today I think we'll start with Casey. He's going to review salmon reintroduction efforts in the Upper Columbia Basin, as well as at the end, hit on a request from the from Commissioner Graybill about where they are with Chief Joe Hatchery and production of fish in the basin there. And then second, Holly and I will work on Lake Roosevelt Northern Pike Suppression and Monitoring Program. So Casey, I hope you can hear us. Take it away, please.
If I may, Chris, Casey, you made public comment to the commission several months back on some issues, correct?
Columbia River.
Yeah, Columbia River. Did you hear?
I made comments during a Columbia River Compact meeting in the spring, I believe.
You didn't make public comment in front of us before?
Nope. No, I don't believe the Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Okay. We had someone, I think, Don, by the name of Casey, sorry for the interruption. Go ahead, please.
Oh, no problem. Thank you. I'll try to share my screen here. All right. Do you see the presentation?
We don't see it quite yet, Casey.
Maybe he needs to turn his camera on.
Casey, we can try an alternative, which is I will put it on and share my screen, and then you can ask me to advance the slides. How's that?
Yeah, that'll work.
Okay. Give me a moment to find it.
Did that work? Did that come up right there? I just did something different.
Yeah, now we've got it.
Now you got it? Okay. I guess we're all set, Chris.
Yeah. Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Again, my name is Casey Baldwin. I'm a research scientist with the Caldwell Tribes, and happy to be here today, have a chance to coordinate and update the commission with this project that I've been working on, and it's one of the really important collaborative projects with Caldwell Tribes and WDFW. First, want to acknowledge some of the additional partners in participation, particularly the Yukut tribes. Caldwell's one of five tribes in the Upper Columbia, including the Kalispels, the Spokanes, the Coeur d'Alenes, and the Kootenays. And then UCUT has some central staff that's also been key in this project in terms of implementing and coordinating it. So, and with that, I will get started. Everybody hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes.
So Chief Joseph Dam blocks approximately 325 kilometers of mainstem Columbia River in the U.S. and another 800 kilometers in Canada. which together is about 57% of the historic potential main stem Columbia River. And you know, this map kind of helps give you a feel for just how much of the Columbia River is included in the blocked area. It's not the minority of the Columbia River. It's the majority of the Columbia River. And of course, this area was extremely important to all the tribes in the Upper Columbia as historic fishing sites, and as a critical component of their way of life in terms of being able to harvest salmon. U.S. portion of the blocked area encompasses approximately 4 million acres, including many traditional native fishing sites along the Sanpoil, the Spokane River, and at Kettle Falls, as well as a number of other smaller streams. Salmon reintroduction is being pursued in three forums. Fish passage was included in the regional recommendation to the U.S. entity for the renegotiation of the Columbia River Treaty. To guide that process, the 15 Tribes Coalition prepared a document that outlined a phased approach. It's still being used as the foundational plan for the UCUT efforts. In 2014, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council amended its Fish and Wildlife Program and included the phased approach to reintroduction for the two U.S. dams, that'd be Chief Joseph and Grand Coulee Dam. In addition to these two processes, several UCUT tribes are pursuing and implementing fish passage under their own initiatives. Phased approach has four phases, and we've completed phase one and are working on phase two now. And decisions regarding phase three and four won't be made until we have completed the studies in phase two to understand the feasibility. And this phase one report is available on the UCUT website. It's been handed over, turned in to the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. What I'm going to do next is just kind of give you a quick overview of what's in that phase one report, and then talk a little bit about where we are in phase two and how we're coordinating with WDFW on that. Well, phase one included six major sections. Evaluated donor stocks, so that'd be which species and stocks of species would be most appropriate. And then a risk assessment around those stocks in terms of what sort of disease or predation risk might be prevalent with one stock or another. Habitat assessments were a big part of what we were working on in phase one. That's evaluating, can the current habitat that exists above these dams still support fish production? And then a review of fish passage technologies, just evaluating what's working elsewhere and is it possible at Chief Joe and Grand Coulee. Life cycle modeling, which was a really important piece that evaluated sort of what are the possible outcomes and could objectives be met. And then future studies and recommendations, and that's where we're focusing in phase two. So the donor stock and risk assessment, it was completed in 2017. It's part of the phase one report. It's also a standalone document published by USGS, as you can see here. But so we evaluated 40 different stocks from five species, and we scored and ranked those based on six criteria. And then just kind of the tip of the iceberg here, the outcome was that it makes the most sense to do the feasibility testing in phase two with Summer Fall Chinook and Sockeye. Because they're unlisted, they're not listed under ESA. They're productive and readily available, and they were the lowest risk to downstream and upstream populations. The available spawning habitat model results from multiple efforts were brought together to show that there's enough habitat to support tens to hundreds of thousands of spawning salmon. And then additionally, a zooplankton productivity model was run to estimate the rearing capacity for juvenile sockeye in Lake Roosevelt, which was in the tens of millions. Habitat availability and suitability results were combined with a baseline management scenario to develop a life cycle model that could predict the number of adult salmon in the ocean for harvest and for escapement. Life cycle model included many assumptions that we're going to be testing in phase two. The baseline management scenario wasn't meant to be a mitigation recommendation, but just a starting point from which to determine if the objectives could be met, and to establish a working hypothesis regarding survival and benefits of implementing green reduction actions. The scenario shown here doesn't include, we modeled a lot of different scenarios and like error bounds around different survival estimates, et cetera. But this just kind of shows for one species, not taking into account all those variations, but for this baseline management scenario, what the possible outcome would be for summer fall Chinook. And it suggests that there would be an escapement of around 41,000 adult summer Chinook for harvest and for spawning escapement. As far as harvest assumptions, we assumed existing harvest rates and frameworks would remain in place. The objective here is to add more fish to the system, not to undermine anybody else's current harvest rates in order to achieve the objective of having enough fish to make it back to the Upper Columbia. We included mostly marked selective fisheries in the terminal area, so assuming there would be a good number of hatchery fish coming back and that the harvest there would focus on those hatchery fish, similar to what happens in the downstream area for the Colville tribes and state of Washington. Phase one included an evaluation of potential solutions to high head passage for both juveniles and adults. Some of the most promising results included and options included floating surface collectors for juveniles and a pressurized flexible transport tube for adults, AKA the WOOSH system. Specific solutions for each project and life stage haven't been selected. The feasibility tests, the coordination with dam owners and operators, and funding are needed before progress can be made on selecting the most appropriate solution for each project. The phase one study conclusions were that there are good options for donor stocks, and we understand the disease risks and believe they're manageable. There are large quantities of habitat in the U.S. that are available and suitable. Even more in Canada that weren't addressed in the report, that passage technology exists and is being used at other high head dams. Life cycle models show promising results, and returning salmon to the blocked area will deliver cultural and economic benefits. And importantly, that the phase one work affirmed that we should move into phase two. And so we have. The phase two, of what's next in phase two can be categorized into a coordination and planning and then implementation. So on the coordination front, we're going to be focused on discussions with dam owners and operators, concurrent work in Canada, fundraising and fostering support from stakeholders. Also, we're working on a strategic implementation plan which will outline the approach to testing the feasibility and the specific studies that need to be conducted to address the critical uncertainties that were identified in phase one. As far as implementation, the strategic implementation plan is going to determine exactly what we need to do, but we know we're going to need to implement studies related to survival and migration timing and behavior in the reservoirs and around the dams. And then we also intend to continue to implement cultural and educational releases. So cultural and educational releases are something that came out of the initial planning work as we were working on phase one. There was a lot of excitement around and anticipation and a desire to get things started with some releases. And so we sort of characterize it as a parallel path to the phased approach. There are some objectives for the tribes that are somewhat different than there might be in the phased approach, which is sort of a scientific stepwise effort to evaluate feasibility. Things like having ceremonies and having fisheries. And so And so the tribes have begun to do this, and you've probably heard something about this. Last year, there was a number of media releases around some of the cultural or ceremonies for releasing some adult summer Chinook in the Upper Columbia. We've actually been doing, several Yukat tribes have been doing cultural educational releases since about 2017. Outreach and community involvement have been a common thread with these efforts. Things like kids raising fish in the classroom and then releasing them, learning about their life cycle and their importance to tribal culture. A lot of ceremonies with prayers, speeches, songs, even canoe landings occurred in the releases in 2019. But adult salmon have been released in creeks on the Spokane, the Coeur d'Alene, and the Colville reservations, and provided a salmon fishing opportunity for the first time in between 60 and 110 years, depending on the location. And these sort of the extension of the educational part of this is a number of these fish have been tagged with pit tags or acoustic tags. So we're also using this to begin to learn some things about the effectiveness of these releases, what the fish do, where they go. And it helps us also get some baseline scientific data that can help set up future larger studies that would be part of the phased approach. As far as current partners and support, I mentioned a few of these already. The Governor Inslee's Southern Resident ORCA Task Force, a number of us participated in that process, and investigating fish passage in the blocked area was included as one of the task force recommendations. And then another big one was the Columbia Basin Partnership that included a number of goals for fish in the blocked area. In terms of support and collaboration with WDFW, several of WDFW staff, Chris, Michael Garrity, and Megan Kernan, all participate in monthly meetings with the Yukut Fish Committee. The Yukut and tribal biologists collaborated with the WFW Fish Health Lab on pathogen testing for IHN. So one of the important components of sort of these early work is that, you know, we don't want to spread a strain of IHN to the blocked area that hasn't already been detected there. It could be problematic for native rainbow trout. And so we needed a non-lethal test for IHN. And it was sort of, it was in development and brand new in 2019 when we were trying to put together the first series of releases. And so we worked with, well, the lab had developed this non-lethal rapid qPCR test, which basically instead of having, like, on brood stock, you would normally kill the fish and take samples that way. But we were able to do it with a tissue sample. It worked really well in terms of the process with the WFW lab. You know, we took samples on a Monday, and we were releasing fish on a Friday, you know, overnight shipping. They prioritized the work and got the samples processed in a day or two at the lab, got us those results back because we had to hold those fish in quarantine and pending those test results. So that was really a neat and a good collaboration in order to make this work. The ORCA Task Force funding helped subsidize that lab work. And we've also been working with WDFW on sort of the regulatory and the permitting end for the releases, which also includes fish transport permits. That's going to wrap up this fish passenger reintroduction portion of what I have to present. with this quote from Francis White, who's a Coeur d'Alene tribal elder. I'm not going to read it to you, but you know, when I hear tribal leaders, you know, speak these words or I read about them, you know, it really reminds me that what we're doing is, you know, we get wrapped up in the meetings and the planning and the biology and analyzing data, and then, you know, you go to one of these ceremonies and hear tribal leaders make statements like this, and it's really an inspirational reminder of how important this is, and that it's bigger than just, you know, what we're working on with the fish and within the bureaucracies, so just thought this was a good quote, and wanted folks to hear and see that. It's important. We often, when we're giving presentations like this, we often have tribal leaders sort of lead off and give the cultural perspective, and that wasn't an option today. So, and I'll wrap that piece up and then move into the Chief Joseph Hatchery. So when Chief Joe and Grand Coulee dams were built, well, Grand Coulee specifically, they made a decision not to provide fish passage and instead to build four hatcheries to supplement downstream fisheries. You're probably very familiar with three of these hatcheries, the Leavenworth National Fish Hatchery, Inniat National Fish Hatchery, and Winthrop National Fish Hatchery. But there was a fourth one that had been promised back in the day. And for reasons, I've heard is that basically World War II got in the way, but I haven't followed all the history of it. But basically it was forgotten for about 60 years. A couple of tribes dusted that off in the 90s, late 90s. And by the early 2000s, the federal government acknowledged that they were supposed to build a fourth hatchery in the Okanagan. And so planning for that began in the early 2000s, and it was finalized and operational by 2013. One of the aspects of it is that it was interwoven with mid-sea PUD mitigation. So I don't know how familiar you guys are, and this is a whole rabbit hole we probably don't want to get into, but the PUDs have some mitigation obligations in each watershed. And so they, that being Grant, Douglas, and Chelan PUDs, during the construction and planning, we were able to sort of weave together the PUD mitigation obligations in the Okanagan and the Columbia with the federal mitigation commitment for building the hatchery. And so that now is basically a partial cost share for O&M and M&E. So it is a BP, primarily a BPA funded operation, but there's a cost share with the PUDs as well. At full program, Chief Joseph Hatchery produces 2.9 million Chinook. It's got four subcomponents. Largest of which, 1.1 million, is an integrated summer Chinook program in the Okanagan. And I think importantly relevant for this commission is that this integrated program is dependent upon wild fish escapement. So we have committed to some of the HSRG guidelines, such as a high percentage of natural origin brood and a low percentage of hatchery origin fish on the spawning grounds. To achieve conservation objectives as well as harvest. And so things like the Caldwell Tribe's mark selective fishery using the purse seine at the mouth of the Okanagan. It also collects the wild brood and the state mark selective fisheries for summer Chinook. Both of those things are very important to this hatchery being able to generate the 1.1 million integrated summer Chinook program. And there's a commitment if the wild fish don't show up, that portion of the program can and will shrink. And then there's about 900,000 segregated summer Chinook that are released directly from the hatchery. and then a couple of spring Chinook programs as well, a segregated spring Chinook program that's released at the hatchery primarily for entirely for harvest. And then the reintroduction program in the Okanagan, which moved some of the production from the Methow over to the Okanagan and uses a experimental population designation under the ESA for that. The above priest, the total above priest dam production has increased considerably due to Chief Joe Hatchery. There's another nuance here with the PUD production. The PUD production actually went down based on a recalculation of their mortality that they were responsible for mitigating for. So had Chief Joe not come online, the production in the Upper Columbia would have gone down significantly. Instead, it has gone up. Chief Joe itself generally hasn't met full program most years. The reasons are varied and complex. One of the big reasons has to do with the groundwater temperature and its effects on pre-spawn survival. Basically, the water keeps getting warmer, even though we're moving into fall during the spawn period, and that makes it gives us a challenge when we start to handle the broodstock. There was also an infrastructure failure, basically a chiller malfunction that caused some mortality at the green egg to fry survival stage. And this was another strong link with WDFW or with the state of Washington. The Orca Task Force funding, there was some Orca Task Force funding that was made available for hatchery infrastructure fixes that would either increase production or allow facilities to achieve their production. And so a couple of tribes were given a chunk of that money, which helped us to replace chillers and take care of one of our survival issues there at Chief Joe. I thought I'd wrap up with just a photograph of the Brewster fishery. Sometimes called the Brewster fishery. It's at the mouth of the Okanagan, very popular for summer Chinook and sockeye. And although the boats are moving at slow speed, there can be collisions here. Not quite as crazy as the buoy 10 collisions you might see on YouTube. But if you want to keep the paint on the side of your boat, you got to pay attention out there. So. And often run into Commissioner Grable, not run into literally, but in fishing in the proximity of. So anyway, with that, I will wrap up. I don't know, Chris, do we want to do questions on this now, or are you going to cover pike and then do all the questions at the end?
Yeah, thanks, Casey. So Chair Carpenter, I would put that to you. Would you like to do questions on this now and then carry on with pike, or do both and then do questions at the end?
I think first thing I see, David Graybell has his hand up, and I see Commissioner McIsaac has his hand up. And then maybe we can open it up for a few questions now, Chris, and then wrap up on the other end of the pike opportunity.
Sounds okay. Good. Let me know when you're ready to move on.
Mr. Graybell, are you there?
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chair. Casey, I'm glad I dodged you that day. It's always nice to see you out in the water, too. I'm sorry we didn't get on Lake Wenatchee this year. We had a lot of fun up there. This reintroduction effort, I know that Commissioner Thornburn also attended one of the cultural reintroductions of ceremonial releases, and those were very moving experiences. And I was very pleased to be part of that. I believe in Casey, I may have this percentage wrong, but I believe after the construction of the dams, the Upper Columbia tribes, that made up 40% of their diet, I believe. It might even be higher. And so this took a real toll on the Upper Columbia River tribes when they lost those returns to the Upper Columbia, I mean, beyond even our borders. And so a lot of people are very much enthused with this, and I appreciate the work you're being done in terms of tracking the fish that have been released and the feasibility of reintroduction in these reservoirs, because we're not certain how these fish will behave when they do in gain population size in those reservoirs. You know, some of the challenges too is it's not only upstream passage, which Woosh, and I believe most of our commissioners have seen demonstrations of that, getting up over high structures, it seems quite feasible. But equally challenging is downstream passage. And I know that I think one of the first times you and I met was at a tour of the dam at Rocky Reach to look at their bypass system. And the importance of downstream passage is critical. And so it's a complex issue, but I am very much impressed with the amount of participation we're getting from a very wide range of agencies to participate in this. I should also mention that the efforts at the hatchery in Bridgeport have resulted in pretty consistent returns that have allowed for harvest throughout the Columbia River, and particularly enjoyed by the Upper Columbia communities. As you can see, the number of boats that are off the mouth of the Okanagan River near the small communities of Pateras and Brewster and Bridgeport, these have tremendous economic impact, as well as providing a tremendous recreational fishery. And the Colville hatcheries contributed greatly to that. Thank you very much, Casey, for the presentation, and nice to hear your voice. Thanks.
Thank you, Dave.
Commissioner Bukajic.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks to Mr. Casey Baldwin for this fine presentation. Before I ask my question, I wonder if you could scoot your slideshow up to three slides earlier where you show the mitigation hatchery that had been forgotten for 60 years. You've got the traditional salmon baked barbecue situation going on there right by the hatchery. Let's see. Yeah, that's the right one. And let me just say, before I ask my question, congratulations and thanks to the Colville Tribe for pushing this thing through the years. We just adopted a Columbia River plan that had a strong please pay your mitigation IOUs component to the policy advocation part of it. And we're going to be entertaining a hatchery policy that also has a mitigation hatchery component that gets to an advocacy for mitigation hatchery debt that has not been paid. And so absent this tremendous policy initiative by the Colville Tribe to pull this out after all these years is a huge success. Now there's this hatchery there that can help with upstream reintroductions and all kinds of benefits. I just wish that that had been taking place back when you could have captured some of the upstream genetics of those summer Chinook that were way upriver fish that had such a spectacular reputation. But this is just an outstanding story, and thanks to the Colville Tribe for pulling this mitigation IOU back on the table. If you could move to slide number 5 for my question. Well, that's the one that has all the phases in this. Phase 1 has got a green check to it. Phase 2 is now ongoing. When we look at pilot salmon reintroductions, I wondered if you could speak to what the successes have been on these pilot presentations. Earlier, you talk about fish cycle modeling showing some good benefits. We just had an enormous sockeye run this year of over 300,000, and I don't know if any of those were the result of your reintroduction fish. But can you speak to any actual, not just life cycle modeling, but any actual proof of the pudding, pilot scale type things that demonstrate your strong feeling that we're ready to move to phase 3?
Yeah, well, I appreciate those comments, and it's certainly a good question. Unfortunately, not a question we're ready to, that we're able to answer just yet. So phase two, right now, our main focus in terms of the phased approach has been, is in phase two, to develop the detailed study designs and cost estimates for those. So the majority of releases, well, all the releases that have occurred to date have been sort of under this parallel path, this other category of cultural and educational. I mentioned we have tagged some fish. Part of the presentation I cut out today in terms of, to meet the timeline, was an expansion on the cultural and educational releases component. Both the Spokanes and the Coeur d'Alene tribe have released juvenile fish with pit tags in them. And even a couple of adult fish have come back from those. So right now, and we have also tagged some adult releases, so some fish that we moved upstream as adults. They weren't generated in the Upper Columbia. They were Wells Hatchery surplus, but we put acoustic tags in them and tracked them around the reservoir. So we are just starting to get some results from that. But basically, we aren't there yet. We haven't begun releasing large enough numbers of fish in phase two to provide answers to those questions. So we don't yet know what the feasibility looks like to move to phase three. And so that's where we are right now.
Thank you.
Casey, another question or comment. I know it's not directly part of your efforts there within the Colville tribe, but I know you work closely with UCUT. And can you tell people a little bit about the sockeye facility across the border and how that could potentially contribute to consistent returns of sockeye to the Upper Columbia?
Yeah, so the Okanagan, you're talking about the Okanagan Nation Alliance hatchery at Penticton, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So another part of the PUD mitigation in the Upper Columbia was to build and pay for ONA to operate this ONA is the Okanagan Nation Alliance. That's a consortium of tribes First Nations in Canada, in the Okanagan portion of Canada. So they operate this sockeye hatchery. Their egg take goal is about 5 million. The releases, it's a little complicated on sockeye because they release fry, which then rear in the lake for the year, for a year before coming out as smolts. But we believe that, and we're coordinating with ONA and Canada on potential for accessing eggs or fry or smolts from that hatchery to help support the reintroduction efforts above Chief Joe and Grant Cooley. And they're also very interested in reintroduction to the Upper Columbia for obvious reasons. And they have also begun cultural or ceremonial releases of sockeye into Arrow Lakes and at Castlegar below Keenley Side. So there are sockeye moving down, small numbers, but in the last couple of years, they have released some sockeye smolts that have come down through Lake Roosevelt. But again, it's still pretty small numbers, primarily for ceremonial, but with some tagging to get some information to help set up the larger studies.
Casey, thank you. I also wanted to point out that the summer Chinook releases get all the attention, but also I'm particularly excited about the releases of spring salmon, would add a whole nother season, quote unquote, to Upper Columbia recreational fishing. And that was something that I learned about later on, and I'm hoping that you're making progress. I believe you've had trouble making goal particular to spring salmon, but are you seeing the potential of getting to goal in those releases in the very near future?
Yeah, the release numbers, because we've been, because those are segregated fish and we aren't as concerned with like broodstock integrity as we are with the integrated summer Chinook, we've been able to backfill some of those release numbers with the fish from Leavenworth, and I think even from maybe from Carson directly. I think what's the obstacle to being able to have fisheries beyond just a small tribal fishery there at the hatchery has been the bad ocean conditions. Basically, about the time returning adults started coming back from the program, the bad ocean conditions were having their effect. And so we've had relatively small returns. In fact, the last couple of years, I think the tribal harvest has been around 100 fish. So, but, you know, we've been able to make brood. And so I think when these fish experience better ocean conditions, there is going to be an opportunity and there is recognition of a potential for a state fishery, in the main stem Columbia, you know, somewhere upstream of the Okanagan to target these fish at, you know, at a particular run size. So it's definitely an option for the future.
Yes. And I should say, you know, I'm excited about the potential for upriver recreational fisheries, but those fish will also contribute to the commercial take for the Bonneville Dam too. But more spring Chinook would always, that's an exciting prospect, and I appreciate your efforts in that direction.
Chair Carpenter, would you like us to move on to the next presentation?
If I could get my screen to unmute, there you go, Chris. Yes, that would be appreciated. Thank you.
Can you see that on full screen?
Yes.
All right. So this second portion, myself and Holly McClellan will present this to you. And as much as we're excited about the idea of reintroducing salmon and steelhead into the upper basin, some of the issues that we have up there are non-native predation that's occurring. And the newest of those is northern pike. And so we'll walk you through what a suppression and monitoring program looks like that we're working collaboratively on with both the Colville and Spokane tribes. So our monitoring and suppression program at this point, we are conducting reservoir-wide surveys. The Colville tribe are assisting with otolith microchemistry and eDNA monitoring. We'll walk you through in this presentation the types of suppression gear that we're using, gill nets, set lines, seines and pike nets, and boat electrofishing. And then also Holly will review a reward program that they're undergoing. The Department of Fish and Wildlife, our portion of this effort in suppressing northern pike up there is really to build a method by which to monitor the efficacy of removal, the removal program as a whole. And so the challenge beginning in around 2015 was to develop a standardized survey methodology that would allow us to monitor catch per unit effort, proportion of positive catch, and what I mean by that term is do we actually catch fish in each net, and then what in what mesh size in the net do we catch them so that we can increase our efficacy of netting, age and size structure. So are we modifying that? Are we killing fish of all ages, and are we reducing the overall age structure and size structure in the reservoir? Section maturity, for us to be able to allow how these fish are growing and also spawning, at what weight maturation rate are they achieving? And then looking at condition, typically in populations of any invasive species, when they show up, they have massive condition, meaning that they're well conditioned, essentially unchecked in forage. And so we're hoping to watch this population not go down in condition, which would infer that they've consumed past their carrying capacity in the reservoir, which then tells us that they've eaten most of our red band rainbow trout and other important native species in the reservoir. So if we look at historically what we've done, our initial survey starting actually in 13 and 14 were some detections of northern pike in the reservoir, but by 15 running a pilot study to look at how could we test the efficacy of our efforts to suppress these populations. So we started with a pilot in 15. In 16 through 18, we had very limited funds, and you see that acronym BOG. That's essentially Bonneville Power Administration, the budget oversight group. So overrun money that came from other projects. We got small pieces of funding to try to just do some spring surveys around Kettle Falls and that study area only. And I think hopefully my cursor shows up as a hand here, but Kettle Falls is that wide portion with the bulk of the red dots in the very northern portion of the reservoir. And then in 2017, we did fall surveys post Fwin, and Fwin is our fall walleye index netting. And so we leveraged all staff, both Colville and Spokane tribe, as well as WDFW staff that were already in the area to do a fall wide reservoir wide survey. And then currently we did one in 2018 that was a fall reservoir wide. In 2019, again, looking for what the most effective season is, we did a spring and a fall reservoir-wide survey. And then in 2020, we intended to replicate the 2019 efforts to do both a spring and fall. I think we all know what happened with a pandemic that interrupted our efforts in the spring. But we will be doing a fall reservoir-wide survey that's planned for November 2nd through the 6th. What we've determined over time is that the bulk of pike exists from Gifford, which is about where the hand is, up north to the reservoir river interface, and that's where we likely will continue to do our monitoring of efficacy of our suppression program. If you can see the dots, and I think Holly will have it, this same map with a little bit more labels on it later in the presentation, the empty dots in the lower reservoir represent places that we've sampled that we have not found fish. And so you start to see that the distribution of pike is in that northern half of the reservoir. And so we're concentrating both our monitoring and a lot of our suppression efforts in that portion. So what have we found out in these studies, and what do we know? Well, we found out that we think that for us to be best at monitoring the efficacy of a suppression program, fall is our best time to do that. And if you look at the red and black bars in this graph, the black bars being fall sampling, or I'm sorry, upper sampling, so upper reservoir sampling, we found out that we see more fish in the upper reservoir and that we can catch them most effectively in the fall. And if, again, go back to that map where I showed you a lot of those empty circles, the red bars at the bottom are those areas in the lower reservoir. Well, we intend to continue to monitor both the upper and lower reservoir, but because the catch rates in the lower reservoir are so low, it's very hard to statistically infer any change in those populations over time with those efforts. We do think, given the amount of funding that we have and the staff that we can throw at this, that we can infer change in the upper reservoir, and we'll continue to use that as our place to monitor our efforts as we go forward. This last bar graph, just wanted to point out what we're seeing as a challenge with this population of pike in the reservoir. So in 2015, we saw very few older age fish, pink, blue, yellow being those fish that we think are sexually mature, age 3 and above. By 16, you start to see a few of those pop up. But our challenge is we've been able to probably suppress this population down to fairly low numbers of age 3 and greater fish, but we're still seeing these pulses of recruitment. There's a couple things that we have going on here. One, it's very hard for us to sample age 1 fish, and so we don't know if we have a spike or a peak of recruitment until we see the green bars, which are age 2. But this is a little bit alarming that we're still seeing this creep up of age 2 fish. So we know we still have plenty of work to do in the future to try to get on top of this population, suppress them sufficiently to prevent impacts to the existing fish community in Lake Roosevelt, as well as to try to keep these fish from moving downstream into the anadromous zone. So at this point, I would invite Holly to finish this presentation up for us. Holly, you with us?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Yes. So for the Lake Roosevelt suppression, we began suppression in about 2015. Since that time, we've removed almost 15,000 northern pike from Lake Roosevelt, as Chris alluded to. The majority of the pike are captured in the middle to the upper sections, as you can see from the colored dots there. And the clear, the open circles in the middle and lower reservoir are empty nets. There are a few pike in the lower section, which you can see from the light green dots. There's a few in the Sandpoil, some in the Spokane River, but not as many. So that's a good sign. We have noticed juveniles in the Kettle area, Evans, Cauville, and Gifford, which are indicated by those red arrows. So those are probably our spawning locations, and those are where we mostly hit real hard with our suppression efforts. And then that's a picture of a pike we caught a couple weeks ago with a red band trout in its stomach. And then the one on the bottom is a pike with a wild kokanee in its stomach, so which is of concern to us, of course. So next, Chris. Okay. Did you want to talk about WDFW, Chris, or you want me to? Oh, Chris, on mute. I'll just go ahead. So WDFW, in 2020, their suppression efforts were reduced, of course, because of COVID, but they were able to do some suppression in Lake Spokane, which is the reservoir on the Spokane River upstream of Lake Roosevelt, which has pike in it. And we're concerned that those pike are going to explode and trickle down into Lake Roosevelt. So that's great that they're focusing there. And I know the Spokane tribe is as well there. So that's good stuff. And so for their 2021 plan, they have 4 months of suppression, March through June, which is the peak spawning period. And they'll use 3 boats during this effort. For the Cauville tribes, in 2020, we were also delayed, of course, but we were able to get back out onto the water June 1st, which is late for us. Since that time, we've set almost 600 nets. And actually, we've removed over 1,000 fish. These are numbers as of last week. So that's good. So we've been playing catch up basically out every single week since June, trying to play catch up on this because we missed that spawning period in April, May. And then for 2021, our plan is we do 10 months of sampling, gill netting a year, February through November. And we do 2 weeks per month with 2 boats is our overall sort of approach. Oh, back up for a sec for the pictures. So that's 129 pike. Those are the juveniles that we removed on October 15 from the Kettle River. And that's one of those hot spawning locations. And that the Kettle River is that picture as well. You can kind of see some of the aquatic habitat there. It's a pikey area. So, okay, Chris. One of the great things we did last year is we got together with the co-managers, of course, the state and the Spokane tribe, but the Kalispell tribe, the Chelan PUD, Grant PUD, and the National Park Service. We all got together and did a week-long suppression effort on Lake Roosevelt. We called it All Hands on Deck Survey. And we did this the first week of May, the 6th through the 9th in 2019. It's kind of the peak. It's right before pike spawn. But it's right when they're staging and they're in the shallow waters. And so together we were able to set almost 500 nets this week and remove about 450 pike that week in just 1 week. So that was a fantastic effort of combining our resources and people and putting a lot of effort out right before the pike spawn. And we had planned on doing that again in 2020 because we thought it was really successful, of course, COVID. But we will try and work together and plan that for 2021 again. And I know the PUDs were happy to participate, and they were calling me again this year and they want to keep participating. So we appreciate all of that. And that's a picture of a pike spawning with full egg skeins. I don't know if you've seen that, but there's hundreds of thousands of eggs in there. And then those are some of the larger boats we use on Lake Roosevelt for pulling nets. This is an expensive operation. Lake Roosevelt's a big water, so you have to have big boats to hold all that gear and to be safe. So you can see some of the investments there that we've all made. So, okay, next. So this overall plan for how we do our suppression, the Spokane tribe and the Cauvilles, we both do suppression February through November, like I said. That all hands on deck is in May. And then some of those other gear types we use, the electrofishing fike net, those target more of the juvenile fish, and we do that later in the fall, like August, September, October. That's the best time to do that. In the state, like Chris, or we talked about earlier, 4 months of suppression and all hands on deck survey there. And so the pictures on the bottom of this, what a Young of the Year pike looks like. As you can tell, this is an August picture, and they come out. They spawn, you know, May, and they come out as June as fish. And so what you can tell from this picture is there's probably multiple spawning events because of the difference in size and how fast they grow. In like 2 months, they're already 8 inches long. And so they're consuming a lot of bugs and other fishes and things like that. And that's another picture of the Kettle River there, how we line the whole shoreline with the gill nets. Those are the buoys on the nets, as you can see. So we'll do that for a week, and then we shift to the other side and hit these areas really hard. So next. Another thing that the Caudill tribes and the state work together on is looking at stranding that's happening in Lake Roosevelt during the spring drawdown. So in Roosevelt, every spring, the reservoir is drawn down between 30 and 50 feet, quite substantial. And during this period, big mudflats occur and strand fish. And we've always sort of been concerned about this with native fish, but it's really hitting the pike, which is actually good. So as you can see, from 15 to 19, we go out every year. And this isn't funded by anybody, this project, but the staff from the state that are up north and my staff who are out there all the time, they go and survey these areas and we just share the data. So I've been tracking this so we can try to understand how reservoir operations maybe affect the stranding. And one day this in March, we went out to Barnaby and collected 404 pike on this one bench. And it's a video, so I can show you kind of what it looks like. Chris, can you play that? If you go down by the date, yeah, down there. I don't know, maybe it won't work. I know videos are hard.
I don't think it's going to work for us, Holly. It doesn't look like I have a play button option because this is a PDF.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, which was interesting is you can see those are all pike in that picture. And this is the all mud flats. That's what the drawdown does to kind of this area. But what was great was 95% of all the stranded fish were non-native fishes, and the majority of them were all pike. So that's kind of good as far as drawdown is maybe not as affecting our native fish like we thought. So we'll continue to work together and collect data on that. The other thing where the Caudill tribes are doing is a reward program. We started this in May of 2017. We have freezers throughout the boat launch, the national park boat launches at the fish cleaning stations because they have power. And so they've allowed us to plug these freezers in, and we've modified them with a lid, as you can see in that picture. And they have bags and head tags and all the information for anglers so they can go to the fish cleaning station and drop off their pike heads. And then we pick them up and process them. And we are doing Visa gift cards. So say someone turns in, 10 heads to me in a month, I'll send them $100 gift card, a Visa gift card. And we have a turnaround time about 3 weeks, which is really good because in the beginning we had some like logistical learning curve to do with a reward program. But now we've got it kind of dialed in. It's pretty fun. And I'm glad that we have a piece where the public can participate and feel like they're a part of this Protect Lake Roosevelt ecosystem. So we're really proud of this program. This year so far, we've given out almost $9,000 to anglers, and fishing's been really hot in September, October, which has been good. And the closed fishery kind of slowed things down a little bit, but as soon as it opened back up, people were out there fishing a lot. And to date, we've given away about $30,000. So next. One of the things we also do is the eDNA monitoring. So WDFW's AIS program, they monitor 385 sites statewide for pike and quagga zebra mussels. And Jesse Schultz is a part of this program, and he helped me develop my quagga zebra mussel monitoring program for the Caudill tribes, which is fantastic. I just want to say I appreciate him greatly. So we were able to launch that this year. So our Caudill tribes our protocols match the states, so we can combine our data if anyone ever wanted to. So I think that's really great. But on top of that, the Caudill tribes monitors 70 sites for eDNA in the Upper Columbia, which you can see are the colored dots. And 10 of these are our quagga zebra sites. And then we have funding to continue this monitoring through 2025. Some of our findings are, so the Kettle River, I don't know if you want to highlight the Kettle River, Chris, with your cursor, but we have detected northern pike 39 kilometers upstream here, and that's one of their major spawning locations. And so we're monitoring that, but where that yellow dot is, no one's actually doing any suppression right there yet because it's really shallow riverine habitat and we can't get any boats in there. So that's something we're going to have to figure out how to attack there. And our group hasn't figured that out yet. And then also in Banks Lake, down at the bottom of the screen, we detected pike down there through eDNA, but there's been no fish recovered. And this, Chris is aware of all of this. And one of the things we think is it's a false positive because a lot of the anglers who fish Banks Lake also fish up at Kettle Falls for walleye. And so DNA will be on their boats or in their water in their live well. And if they launch down a Banks Lake, they can spread it. So we've been, and the state also does a creel in Lake in Banks Lake, and they haven't detected an angler catching a pike. So we're not quite sure yet, but our next step would be to go out and survey with gill nets this area. And I think the state might have that on their agenda. I'm not sure, depends, I guess. So that's somewhere we wanna look. We're worried about that. And then all the green dots are no detections. So in the lower reservoir, it mirrors our survey work with our gill nets. It's really low pike densities down there, which is a good sign. And then we have not detected anything in Rufus Woods or below Chief Joe Dam in Wells Pool or the Okanagan. And that's really good news so far. I think that has that's a positive for our work. Because according to how fast fish have been moving downstream the pike from the Ponderay to Roosevelt, they should already be below Chief Joe Dam by the miles they were moving every year. So I think we've at least slowed it down. So we'll continue to do this monitoring every year. Next. It's the PDF. Oh, there's multiple pictures in this one. Oh, well, so... So we use otolith microchemistry to try and understand fish movements of the pike. And we look at the strontium isotopes. So in 2019, we analyzed 41 pike. And what this is, so if you look at the bottom graph, across the bottom, the zero is the center of the otolith. And then that's the strontium levels as it grows out to when you captured it, you know, so the 3000 is the end. And then the other axis is the strontium isotopes. And then we've gone out and characterized the water for strontium. So that's the Kettle River is very different than Lake Roosevelt, which is different than the Ponderay and the Spokane Arm. So it's more like zoomed up, like big watershed differences in strontium. So we want to understand if pike are coming in from the Ponderay River, if they're coming from Long Lake or what they're doing. So we were able to, we've been doing this. And for Spokane River pike, all five of the pike that we looked at came from Lake Roosevelt and not from Long Lake or the Spokane River itself. So that's good news that there are the fish in Long Lake aren't coming down so far. And our counterparts in BC were concerned about the pike up by them in Castlegar. And they wanted to know if they were coming from the Ponderay or if they're coming from us in Lake Roosevelt. And they're also really concerned because the Keeley-Sai Dam has a lock. So fish can actually move upstream into the Arrow Lakes through that lock. But we haven't detected any pike in our eDNA surveys yet up there. So that's good too. But anyways, the fish in Castlegar had three different life histories. Some were coming from the Ponderay River into up by Castlegar. Some spent their whole life at Castlegar, and then some of them we detected moving between Castlegar and BC and down to the Kettle River and back. So we know the fish are moving through that whole corridor. And then this particular fish in this picture is the first pike we pulled out of the Sampoil River on the lower reservoir. And from its microchemistry, it looks like it spent most of its life in the Ponderay River and then came downstream and came into Lake Roosevelt where we caught it. So this is just a technique to try and help us understand movements. Next. And then looking to the future, the co-managers of Lake Roosevelt will continue to look for funding and implement our suppression and monitoring programs through at least 2025. At that time, then the co-managers will reconvene and adaptively manage the future direction of our program. So next. And then we just wanted to many thanks to our co-managers, the Spokane Tribe, and the long list of partners we have in the Upper Columbia area. Not just the Upper Columbia, but the Pacific Northwest, really. Any questions?
Yes, Commissioner Thorburn has her hand up.
Great, thank you. I have a couple of questions. I'll just make a comment. I was able to participate in the all hands on a DFW boat. It was kind of scary to see the couple of really large, gravid females that we caught. The eggs that you showed, they're pretty darn productive. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, most of them were young fish, but we did pull in quite a few northern pike that day. My first question is there a biologic explanation that you think about for the distribution of the fish in the reservoir, or is it simply where they're entering and the suppression is holding them there? What's your thinking on the distribution?
For me, I think they've just been trickling in from upstream, and there's new habitat where there's no other pike, and then they set up shop, sort of spawn in that area, and as soon as they eat most of the food and there's more competition, they start to spread out and they're moving downstream. And each of one of those key areas are sort of backwater like bay areas. So it's sort of like they're migrating down and finding the next best place where there's plenty of food, young fish, juveniles to eat, and there's habitat for spawning, and they set up there. And as soon as they get their densities get high enough, then there's competition and they move out. Kind of seems like that's what's happening to us, because they're just sort of going down river incrementally.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Holly. I think that's exactly what we have going on there.
Commissioner Graybill has a question.
I've got another question, Larry, if I could.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
And this one's probably for Chris. Sorry, it's snowing really hard here and it makes my internet terrible. Chris, is Avista involved at all in the Lake Spokane efforts? I ran into an Avista biologist about a year ago on Long Lake and talked to him about northern pike. Could they set up an incentive program or something like that? Are we working with them at all?
Yeah, so unfortunately, northern pike became an issue after they finalized their FERC license. And so all hydropower companies that aren't federal are regulated under the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And so their FERC license then sort of has a bunch of biological or mitigation requirements, and pike didn't really pop up as an issue when we were negotiating the FERC license, and so it's not part and parcel to what they've done. Having said that, Avista has helped us where they can financially, and we've also been innovative with some of the FERC license monies that were out there. One of the things that's done in Lake Spokane is Avista has a tremendous water quality problem. It's a phosphorus loading issue in Lake Spokane. And common carp are in there, and they resuspend a lot of sediments and nutrients that then lead to large blue-green algal blooms in the summers. So one of the things that we've done is contracted with Avista under the FERC license to remove common carp from the population. Well, it just happens that we use the same gear, which is gill nets, to get at those common carp, and that they're effective at catching pike. And so we're doing a couple things. We get a contract with Avista to control carp. We combine that with the monies that we have to increase our effort out there, and we're killing two birds with one stone. So we're getting both common carp achieving FERC license requirements, as well as we're controlling or suppressing pike numbers out there at the same time. So they are indirectly supporting us. And like all hydropower companies, Avista has their financial challenges right now, and when they have the opportunity, they've stepped up and tried to be a partner in this issue.
Commissioner Graybill.
Thank you, Chair Carpenter. Holly, good to see you. Great presentation.
Thank you.
That I was encouraged in seeing is an uptick in angler participation.
Yes.
Really good. I mean, I believe that recreational anglers can have a very, very high impact on assisting in that suppression effort.
Yes, I agree. Mm-hmm.
And I'll continue to try to keep getting the word out about that program.
Thank you.
And I'm not sure how far you are in this presentation, but were you going to do anything on sturgeon today?
No, Commissioner, we were trying to keep it at an hour, and we thought our challenge would be these two subjects and then the questions that go along with them. I think we could probably occupy 2 or 3 hours just with white sturgeon. But again, what I said early in the presentation is we do a lot of things cooperatively with the Colville tribe. We don't think we could be nearly as successful as we are without them. And white sturgeon is certainly one of those.
Chris, we'll make sure to get you guys back on again. This has been very, very informative. I just want to thank you, Chris, and Casey, and Holly for your time. Very enlightening and nice to learn new things. So I appreciate it. Anything else from any of the other commissioners?
Yeah, Larry, I think you and I need to go be a recreational fisherman for one of those big pikies over there.
Yeah, I think probably pretty soon, like maybe tomorrow afternoon.
I'll teach you some Upper Great Lakes pike fishing secrets.
I'll probably have to borrow Chris's boat. I don't have any boats anymore. I used to have hundreds of them. Now I have none. But my last question is anybody consuming pike? Does anybody eat them, either the recreational folks or any of the tribal folks, or are they just, as I always heard, they're kind of a scrap fish? That's what Brad told me.
No, look at this. That's a spearing decoy from.
Well, I think.
Pike, don't be an elitist now. Pike is good to eat. You just got to know how to clean them.
Right. Yeah. There was a learning curve to show people how to fillet them properly. And for us, we did do a contaminant survey on them to make sure they were safe to eat. And the majority, like the smaller fish, less than 24 inches is what we tell people are safe to eat. And we do have some of the membership experimenting with them. So any fish that's edible after it's been in the gill net, we'll give away. And we do give away any like bycatch that we collect as well to try and, the membership is very appreciative of that. And they're starting to get into that. So.
Well, Holly, why don't you go ahead and give a couple to Chris, because this is Friday. Friday's fish night, and he'll be happy with that. So, all right. So, yeah. Hey, thank you all. We got to move on to other things, but thank you all, and get home before there's too much snow out there. Kim say it's coming down bad.
Thank you for your time. It's much appreciated.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye, guys.